Welcome to the eRetina podcasts on AMD fluid resolution. This is the second episode in this program. In this section, Drs. Frank Holtz, Giovanni Sterenghi, Martin Zinkernagel, Jordi Mones, and Peter Kaiser will talk about fluid level decisions in wet AMD treatment. We'd like to thank Novartis and Zeiss for providing independent medical education support.
There's a question from the chat, and perhaps, Peter, we may pick your brain again. What is your fluid threshold to initiate anti-VEGF treatment and to retreat?
So those two thresholds are very different. So it, to me, it depends a lot on a lesion type. So a type 2 or type 3 lesion, I know these lesions are going to go very rapidly, and I really have no reason not to treat the patient immediately. The type 1 lesions are a little bit difficult, especially when you have, say, a double layer sign. So you have a non-exudative wet macular degeneration, the patient may be seeing very well. At that point, they probably don't need treatment. Sort of like in the past with the occult with no classic CNV, we'd watch for disease progression because these shots are pretty safe, but they're not completely safe. So in a type 1 lesion, I may wait until there's some evidence of disease progression. At follow-up, basically any intraretinal fluid, I'm going to retreat a patient. Any subretinal fluid, I don't like to tolerate it too much subretinal fluid early, but type 1 lesions in a long-term subretinal fluid oftentimes very difficult to have it disappear. And some studies have shown that allowing it to disappear, treating until it disappears, actually leads to worse outcomes. So I'm a little more tolerant of subretinal fluid, and I'm most tolerant of sub-RP fluid. As long as that's not increasing, I'm not really trying to chase it.
Thank you for this clear-cut statement. And perhaps you mentioned the anatomic level where the fluid builds up. And we have a question here from the chat dealing. You already alluded to this, perhaps Jordi. How does it matter where the fluid accumulates and what level response intra-retinal versus subretinal versus sub-RP?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let's start for the last one that Peter mentioned, the sub-RP. When you have a dome of sub-RP fluid, that's likely to be some sort of a second choriocapillaries that is working, supplying the RP. So that's not fluid, that's a CMB, that's a good CMB. So the problem is when that CMB decompensates and creates subretinal fluid, intraretinal fluid, then is when we have the problem. Intraretinal fluid, no question, unless it's a structural cyst, very chronic cyst, intraretinal fluid has to be dealt always. Subretinal, we don't deal with subretinal when it's completely refractory to treatment. That's a different thing. Sometimes lesion type 1 are refractory and you cannot get rid of them, of it completely, and then you make a trade and you make a commitment. But the aim should be to get rid of any fluid, because remember CSC, when you have accumulated fluid subretinal in CSC, at the end it's toxic and the photoreceptors get atrophy. So fluid is no good. There is a bad axioma here. So type 1 protects, type 1 causes subretinal fluid. But the axioma saying subretinal fluid protects, that's not true. So that's the mistake on this triangle of axioma. Mm-hmm. Fluid does not protect.
Excellent. Very clear-cut statement. Question to Giovanni from the chat. Do you inject for only sub-RPE fluid in absence of any sub- or intraretinal fluid?
Pure. Well, I think it really depends on the cases. If we have a patient that already had subretinal fluid and sub-RPE fluid, and, we are able to control both at the beginning, and then it started to increase the subretinal fluid, sub-RP fluid. Sometimes we are a little bit more aggressive and we treat also the sub-RP fluid, but it's not the rules. It depends. Following the patient, you can actually decide if you need or not. It's not like a subretinal fluid or intraretinal fluid, like Peter says, where you actually want to have much more control of that.
Mm-hmm. So aiming at physiological conditions of this.
Exactly, and following, the patient.
Yeah. Now, here is another question, and this was a topic also during the eRetina meeting. recent data indicating that fluctuation, bouncing back and forth of fluid, may have an impact on the outcome. Martin, what is your view on that?
Yeah, so fluctuation is just a sign of active disease, and that with treatment, you're not controlling this disease. So it's a disease that is not sufficiently treated. And I think this reflects that the outcomes are so poor. So in a way, some patients really need extremely intensive treatment in order to control the disease and avoid fluctuation.
Mm-hmm. Here, another question on real-world outcomes. That's a good question. Real-world outcomes for anti-VEGF therapeutics sometimes differ from clinical trials, Peter.
Well, the biggest reason is number of injections. I mean, if you look at clinical trials versus real-world studies, due to nature of insurance, patients, practice, truths, we simply can't do the same number of injections in clinical trials as we can in real world. Mm-hmm.
So we have to live with this discrepancy, also we try to bring it closer together.
We hope that this eRetina podcast advanced your understanding on fluid level decisions in the treatment of wet AMD patients. To hear more on this topic, listen to the next episode of the AMD Fluid Resolution podcast.